ladies and gentlemen. Today we are going to discuss what I believe to be one of the greatest frauds, and it's called this post-PC era. Now, some of you are going to be like, oh yeah, cool subject, let's talk. And some of you are going to be like, what the hell are you talking about? What is post-PC era? The post-PC era agenda might just be one of the most ridiculous assertions on mankind when it comes to the technology we've been using up to date. What the post-PC era is, in concept, is that up until the 21st century, we all used a desktop PC. You know, a big tower, wired up to a keyboard, a mouse, and then a big monitor. It was like this disjointed thing. Steve Jobs and company managed to put it in an all-in-one, and then everyone copied it beautifully, so now we have some all-in-ones. Now, they still sell everything, right? They still sell desktop computers and stuff. But then we had the debut of the smartphone. And the smartphone has these incredible processors in them. So they can do some amazing things. I mean, really, it's just unceasingly amazing what they can do in these telephones. And they also added tablets to it. So now, all of a sudden, this weird agenda pops out, and Tim Cook from Apple, the Iago of all company profit lines, he's sort of at the tip of the spear of this whole thing. But you'll hear pundits and columnists that are you know, told to write articles about this. But Tim's the one that walks on stage and keeps talking about this post-PC era. And what that means is, hey kids, we want you to think that PCs, desktop computers are stupid. We want you to think that our iMacs are stupid. We want you to think that our Mac Pros are stupid. And all you PC kids out there who have a tower with a bunch of expandability, big massive video cards, so you can play great games and, you know, 16 terabytes worth of hard drives in them, those are stupid too. Having a big giant monitor in 4K is stupid. Having an actual physical keyboard and a mouse is stupid. That's what Tim Cook is trying to tell you. This post-PC era nonsense is all about losing your sovereignty. And the backstabbers of the world who tow these agendas are the only people out there suggesting such a thing. Well, how could they possibly suggest getting rid of PCs, you might ask? Well, let's break it down one piece at a time. When I got into the internet programming side of things in the mid-90s, obviously the only device that ever hit the internet was a desktop computer. There were cell phones, but none of them had any level of internet access. There were no such thing as the Star Trek tablets, you know. Apple had its little Newton thing, of course, before that. But it was just relegated to desktops. And now we have these devices called cell phones. And today the traffic on any website is mainly cell phone based. And there's nothing wrong with it ebbing from a PC predominant world to a mobile predominant world. I don't have any problem with that transition. But to suggest that we get rid of the tool that made the phone possible is ridiculous. But now, how can you get rid of a PC desktop? Well, there's a couple things. Your hard drive is now either in a tiny little RAM card on your phone, which you pay ungodly amounts of money for, right? You know, it's funny how Apple wants to charge you several hundred dollars more for a little bit more RAM space on your tablet, on your iPad, you know. Pennies on the nothing. It costs nothing, and they're making hundreds of dollars. It's like printing money. But people are stupid enough, the fanboys are stupid enough to pay for it. Now, if you're rich, you don't care. Knock yourself out. But there's some kids that are struggling and trying to make decisions about other things they could buy with that money. And so I just think it's ridiculous. But your hard drives are now largely going to the cloud. Now, we're nowhere near going to the cloud completely because of a couple things. One, America has the slowest internet on planet Earth, believe it or not. We're taught that we have the greatest, we have the worst. Wireless modems are not able to wirelessly transmit things at high speeds. And so even if you got I have a 300 megabit line at my house, which means about 30 megabytes per second down and about 3 megabytes up per second, which is super duper fast for this day and age of 2016. But my modem can't transmit 30 meg down. It can only get to about 1620. So I'm losing a certain percentage. So the internet backbone in America isn't big enough for a designer, a movie maker, to have gigabytes and terabytes of images and movie files go up to some weird cloud. So we all have to have hard drives to pull this stuff off to keep our careers, basically. But your average Joe, they just have little Word documents, contact sheets, some emails. A lot of people use these free email services online anyway, and so they never store anything on their phone, except for just the temporary, what I've read, emails. And so the anatomy of a computer desktop is going into the cloud, or it is being usurped by miniaturization inside of these smaller devices, phones and tablets. Now again, some of that's perfectly fine, and I don't really care if a cloud exists. I don't have to put anything up there, unless the post-PC era succeeds. Now, some of you may remember when Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak created Apple, the only option anyone really had in terms of having access to a computer was to access a mainframe. If you had one in your home, the idea was that you had a terminal. It had no processor in it to speak of, and it had no hard drive of any kind, and it had a wire that went out the back of your house, over a telephone line, talk to the mainframe, and only thing that was happening was the characters were being transmitted to your terminal. And so if you ran a program, you weren't running it on your local computer, because it's not a computer, it's a terminal. It ran it on the mainframe, and then the mainframe spits out the data to your terminal. It's sort of the most beautiful, tyrannical way to run a society, in that everything that society does is on a centralized server, therefore surveillance is completely taken care of. And that's where we were, and that's why Steve Jobs obsessed in his podium speeches about getting rid of Big Blue. He gave power to the people by putting a personal computer inside everyone's house. Now remember, PC, that name, personal computer, was actually coined by IBM in 1981. After sort of the coup de grace investment groups went into Apple and said, we're going to distract Wozniak from doing any hardware development, and we're going to essentially dilute the power of Steve Jobs. In the end, we will have taken over this computer. We're going to sabotage the Apple II into an Apple III that no one's going to want to use, and we're going to take a tremendous amount of money and put it into this thing called the Lisa, which is going to crash and burn at $9,999 in 1979. That's like a $100,000 computer today. Unbelievably expensive system. So Apple was almost completely sabotaged until Steve took a rogue group of about 12 people and made the Macintosh computer and resurrected the company and kept it from dying. So we've said on the show a couple times, I don't think I've said it too much on Deep Thoughts, but there's something I want to connect in your mind, right? There's a word called sovereignty. Sovereignty, in its most fundamental definition, is that you have a domain that is your place to go where no one can disturb you, where you can own the domain, right? If I could own this house and own the land and not have to pay taxes to my state, I simply own this. And no one could take it away from me lawfully, and I could take it away with guns. But if I owned the plot of land where this house is on, I would have a sovereign piece of land. I believe the only group in America that actually has sovereignty is the Native Americans, who've been given reservations, which they don't have to pay taxes on. In fact, they get taxes paid, they get, you know, checks paid to them because of the atrocities towards their people. Now, it's still a really screwed deal, of course, right? But that's true sovereignty. Now, to take that a little bit further, the reason why they call it real estate is it's short for royal estate, right? The royalty of the world owns all the real estate in the world, and you pay taxes to Caesar or the Queen to have access to a rented part of land. America used to have sovereign land. We no longer have sovereign land. You have to pay taxes based on the square footage of your land, the square acreage, right? Now, why mention that in a post-PC era conversation? Very simply, we actually have sovereignty within our desktop computers. What am I talking about? I'm talking about a hard drive. When you go to your local electronics store and you buy a hard drive, internal, external, doesn't matter. You own the drive, right? You don't have to pay taxes on the drive. It is your sovereign digital bits written on a disk that you can put your information in, and it becomes your property, you know, the entire time. There are laws that protect police officers and intelligence agents from raiding that drive without probable cause, without a warrant to do so, at least before 9/11. But the second that you use someone else's drive in a cloud, it's not your possession anymore. If you read the fine print on a lot of these cloud services, you actually don't even own your files anymore. They could cut you off, raid the drive, read your favorite, you know, read your new movie script, take pictures of your family and put them inside frames to help the frame sell. They could take your little, romantic moment you film with your wife or your husband and sell that on a video. Citizens gone wild, right? And that's why the cloud is dangerous. You never own what's yours. Now, there's benefits to the cloud in that the clouds are heavily backed up, so that if your house burns to the ground, that sovereign drive that's going to die in the fire, it's going to overheat and melt. And it's not that you can't get the data off those disks, but let me tell you, it's extremely expensive to do so. But if you got your stuff in the cloud, you're cool. So now, approaching the cloud technology, we have to make some decisions. What are all the things that I would never want to lose if my house burned down, data-wise? Well, you'd have some files. Maybe you have some files you don't want anyone to see. Maybe you run the risk of having a drive in your house that has a specific private directory and you don't want anyone to see it. Okay. If you get really, really clever, you will find a way to encrypt those files on your drive and then push them to the cloud. And that way, at least, you know, idiots can't get to your data. If you want to get clever, maybe you have a safety deposit box at the bank and you have an external drive that you sort of rotate in and out. You make a monthly visit, quarterly visit, and you just maybe rotate out a couple terabytes of data because you don't need anyone else to have access to it. You don't want the cloud to have access to it. And to date, we really haven't had anyone raid a cloud. You know, we've had our credit card services raided, which is usually the NSA goes in and raids MasterCard and Visa because they want all your records. MasterCard and Visa doesn't want the liability of actually giving it over to the NSA for any future litigation. So they say they were hacked. NSA gets all their data. And that's why you never find out whoever does these hacks, because it's a government wink, wink, nudge, nudge program that runs annually. So the post-PC era has the initial objective of removing your sovereignty. And it's by demonizing you owning the device that could give you sovereignty. They're demonizing you having a local computer, which allows you to have terabytes and terabytes of space. I went to Fry's Electronics, which is the local electronics store here in California. You can look at their website, frys.com. It's a great place to buy stuff here in America. But they're selling 4 terabyte drives for about $130. And you have to buy an enclosure if you don't have one, or you have to have a bay inside your computer to put them in. But 4 terabytes, that's a tremendous amount of space, right? Again, that's the first thing. Get all of the data from the population into the cloud such that nothing can be done on the cloud. Imagine me recording this video, and let's just say that it's 10 years in the future, and instead of having a 300 megabit line, I have a 3,000 megabit line, and it's several gigabytes up. It's the same transmission rates between the I/O of a drive and a desktop as it is to the cloud. Let's say that we rewire our house to actually have Ethernet in the house, right? I mean, it's absurd we're building homes without Ethernet, and it's 2016. You should have a power outlet. Get rid of the phone line and put the Ethernet right in its spot. Some Cat 7, right? And then we wouldn't need anything else. You wouldn't have to have wireless communication throughout your house because you'd have solid state connections. Why not? Why not get the fastest bandwidth we have? But let's say that that's the case. And I record this video. And let's say I record something exposing a bunch of cabals. And for whatever reason, I'm able to put together 1 plus 1 and it equals the next 9/11 before it happens. And now I'm uploading my audio file, which I'm recording off to the side here, and I upload the video. And somebody knows that I create these shows. And I've become a problematic person because I keep exposing the thought processes around this. I'm not saying I do that today, but let's just say I get to that point. Now they can look at my stuff on the cloud. They can take a look at my stuff way before I get a chance to edit everything together and put it out there. Now they can still do it today. But if it disappears off my local drive or my computer has a problem, well, you know, it might be a little obvious if I put a really hot file in there and all of a sudden my computer takes a shit. Who knows, right? Imagine law enforcement gets involved because this thing's on a cloud. My stuff isn't protected. Or let's say they want to screw me over and so they grab a bunch of other files on the cloud and they synthesize up this story about me and make me a patsy. Just like James Holmes. The Colorado shooting kid, right? The movie theater kid, right? So this situation, and that's a very fringy thing, I know. And I don't think most of us would ever fall in that category. But that's sort of what's being demonized. But now let's look at the second side of this thing. I'm a very creative person. I make money with my computers. I make money with every single square inch of my hard drives. I've run every computer into the ground. I use them for 5 to 6 years apiece, maybe even 8 years. Actually, I have a computer that's 8 years old and it's still kicking ass. And I make them make money for me. I force them to, either through engineering projects or art projects or whatever, video, movie, whatever. I happen to be an expert at what I do. And when I think about this stuff going off to tablets and telephones, I immediately see very vividly the creative input mechanisms. The only way you can really viably do this kind of work disappearing. But let's. I know what some of you are thinking. If you're coming in for the very first time because you saw the subject on YouTube and you don't have any other idea about what I talk about, you might be going, dude, you're full of shit. I got a keyboard for my tablet. Which for me is just an IQ test you're failing, right? What's a portable computer? It's a monitor with a keyboard unit underneath with the CPU and the fans and all that good stuff, all that data input on the bottom part of the computer, and it just has a flip lid, which just has your monitor on it. And all they're doing is they're taking your hard-earned money, they're creating an inferior CPU, an inferior data input mechanism, right? You don't have all the USB and stuff easily available. You have to use weird proxy cables that kind of aggregate all the input devices in. You have to buy these cheapy-ass keyboards that you have to pay $80 for, if not $150 for, right? And you plug them into your slow little tablet. And you pat yourself on the back that you've actually innovated something. Oh, but the new iPad's 10 inches across. I sat there and fought the wars of the laptops for the last 20 years of going from these tiny 9-inch screens all the way up to 17-inch monitors on laptops, right? I have one of the last 17-inch Mac Pro laptops in existence, right? But now they're selling us inferior hardware. Hey, it's impressively inferior, right? It's impressive they can miniaturize stuff down that far. It's impressive how they can create a retinal display. But now people are super duper impressed that this unit gets smaller and slower. But they end up paying. They don't pay quite as much as a laptop, but come on, the new iPad 10-inch one, iPad Pro, with the keyboard attached to it, you're over $1,000. You know, and if you buy the cellular plan, you're well into the thousands. You're $1,200 to $1,500, especially if you take your monthly bill and add that to your actual cost. Now, let me ask you, how are you going to run Photoshop? It exists on these devices, I think, but how are you going to run, a professional music editing environment? Pro Tools? How are you going to run Final Cut Pro 10? How are you going to rasterize a movie like the ones that I make that are an hour and 45 minutes long or 2 hours long? How are you actually going to use the touchscreen to move clips around and make it all happen? You're buying into an absolutely inferior hardware experience and being told that if you hang on to desktops, you're antiquated. When I think about the billions of dollars that these software and hardware companies make by selling desktops, and someone like Tim Cook walking on stage and saying post-PC era, it blows my mind. Him saying that word is a big F you to all these companies that make billions of dollars off selling desktops or peripherals for desktops or software for desktops. Nobody envisions buying a $1,000 piece of AutoCAD for an iPad, but they envision paying $900+ for AutoCAD and Maya on a desktop. But when he says post-PCR, he's erasing that revenue. Now, consequently for Apple specifically, Apple no longer competes in the phone market. Apple no longer competes in the iPad market, in the tablet market. Android is completely handing them their ass every single day. Android's not playing the game of slowing down devices with previous patches yet. Again, I have a Galaxy Note 3. It got faster the last update I put on it. Way faster. Games that were chugging are now smooth as glass. Hey, my friends with iPhone 5s, when they type, there's full second pauses during word wrapping. Okay. The iOS hasn't changed forever, right? Oh, they release new updates all the time and they error 53 your phones and kill them and erase all of your data. Especially if you use any outside third-party maintenance for your Apple products, they've got software that penalizes you. They're making these products with inferior hard drives, inferior video cards. One of the biggest things that happens with iMacs nowadays is that the hard drives crash really quickly. Within 2 years, usually about a year and a half, the hard drive just simply dies. You know, all your stuff's on there, right? Which is why you always need a backup drive on the side. But it dies, and then what do you have to do? Well, it's actually pretty damn easy to replace a hard drive if you've done any computer maintenance in your life. If you've never done any computer maintenance in your life, I don't recommend you try it. But there's step-by-step pages on the internet that shows you exactly how to do it. You'll need some special screwdrivers and that kind of thing. Again, if you've done computer maintenance on a Mac and you have your star-fitting jewelry screwdrivers and that kind of stuff, you're fine. But the second you replace the drive in the Mac, there is a certain jumper switch that's actually invisible to the drive that you take out of the computer that Apple put in there. And when you put the new drive in and you boot the computer up, you know what these guys do? Apple runs a program, a diagnostic program that says that's not one of our drives and it's not one of our technicians that installed it. And so as a penalty to you for replacing a defective hard drive, a piece of crap hard drive that we put in our computers so that we can sell it to you cheap, even though they're charging more, you know, pounds per square inch for their systems, and usually it's worth it because the experience is a little bit better. They run the fan on the HD sensor, right? The HDD fan, which is the fan that runs on top of the hard drive. They run it at maximum RPMs. So now you turn your iMac back on and you hear the fan blasting 100%, deafens the room. And someone has thankfully made a little fan application which actually studies the sensor heat and actually throttles the fan down. One guy wants $40 for it, but there's another one that's free. Making the desktop experience just that much worse. But now I write film, okay? I know that the favorite, you know, there's many screenwriting software packages out there that run on these tablets, especially the iPad. Problem. I have a teeny tiny screen that I have to see my script on. It's tiny. It is unacceptably tiny. If someone created a laptop before this whole cell phone tablet explosion and said, hey, look, we have this new fast laptop. It's got a 10-inch screen. Don't you feel special? While there's 17-inch MacBook Pros out there, who would think that 7 inches smaller would be acceptable at all? As an artist, you need to see as much of your material as possible. And so you might say, well, they have retinal displays. And it's like, okay, if you're under 35, that's going to work out great. Maybe. If you can develop any skills to do this kind of stuff. But if you're over 35 and your eyesight starts going bad, now what? You have to see teeny tiny writing on the screen just to see a full page of dialogue? What if you're in Photoshop and you're running massive plugins? You have 100 layers of stuff to make up a drawing, a professional drawing. The iPad's going to choke. It's not going to be able to handle that. And if you need to do anything, you know, process a layer really heavily, rotate a gigantic layer, or you're working in anywhere from 300 dpi to 1400 dpi because you're creating poster art for movies, these devices are not going to be suitable. I mean, maybe in 10 years they will be, right? But still, those teeny tiny screens. There's a word called obligatory, which means it's obligated to occur. Our desktop computers are obligatory machines. They are the minimum amount of space that we need to do these jobs properly. And because the screen sizes have ebbed up from teeny tiny, right? The Macintosh 1984 was a 9-inch screen. PCs were 13-inch monochrome screens back in the day. And we went through this whole birthing process of going from monochrome monitors all the way up to color monitors, all the way up to bigger monitors, slow processors up to big processors, inferior software to superior software. And now all of society is used to the amenities that make creativity possible. And just at the summit of desktop technology, innovation, we have CEOs now coming out saying this era needs to end. It just arbitrarily needs to end. Now, I'm going to put forth a suggestion that one of the reasons why these companies want their desktop units to die, because that's what Tim Cook is saying. He's simply saying, we don't want to make these devices anymore. And he'll deny that maybe if it gets cornered. But when you say post-PC, what could you possibly mean? Other than we don't want to make iMacs anymore. We don't want to make laptops anymore. We don't want to make the Mac Pro anymore. And we don't think any of these PC folks with this tower and a monitor that's connected to it, which is, again, 99% of your gamers, right? They're hardcore gamers that make billions for these companies, right? You might have a really good Clash of Clans that might make $500 million in a year. You take a World of Warcraft, when it's bumping 11 million subscribers at $15 a month, and they pay anywhere from $40 to $80 for the product, you're talking about billions a year. That's what a PC era allows a company to create. A big, fat profit margin. Again, take AutoCAD. Take Maya. Take Nuke. Isn't Nuke like $9,000, the full-blown version of it? How could they possibly sell that? Oh, yeah, I've got this 10-inch little flat thing, and I'm going to spend $10,000 on software to run my business on it. So you might say, dude, you're just talking about the difference between professionals and consumers. And consumers don't need what professionals need. Okay, let's split that hair for a split second. What's the difference between a kid that plays music and a kid who listens to music? Exclusively, right? One guy exclusively plays and writes his own stuff, and one person exclusively listens to MP3s. It's access to the instrument. If you don't have access to a guitar, a set of drums, or any other thing that you want to play, you don't get to participate in the creation and the sovereign ability to create these products. So simply saying that there's a developer or an artist and a consumer, and these are just, hey, they're just natural, man. Okay, well, one, we're talking about really demonizing this other side, this development side, from ever existing. They want the the approval from society to never produce these things. They want to stop producing these things so and have you not complain. So you're not upset with them. They don't make something that allows you to make things. But I'm going to put forth that without the tool laying around the house, you may never find your destiny. I have friends of mine who are utter famous rockers, man. And when you listen to their stories about how they finally became these rockers, it's because there was a guitar laying around the house. My buddy's Bobby Blotzer, he actually bought a guitar and his buddy bought drums. And they eventually just traded one for one. And he became one of the best drummers in the world. But now what if someone like Tim Cook said, drums shouldn't exist. Guitars shouldn't exist. All you should do is somehow listen to MP3s of those instruments actually playing. Well, then how does a kid ever get access to the device to become amazing? They don't. And if they're told that it's unfashionable to own the devices that create things, where does society go from there? You know, for those of you over 40, you know for a fact that things were better 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Music didn't have to be auto-tuned. Music was actually original. You know, and everyone always takes a blues riff from here and there, but I'm just saying that they packaged it up. They could create great content, and you weren't allowed to get on stage unless you could really pull it off. But now guys like Tim Cook, anybody who utters post-PC era, some columnist somewhere, right? I'm sure that columnist is writing all of their columns on some detachable keyboard from their iPad, right? Or their tablet. I also believe that it's cheaper to make iPhones and iPads than it is to make a big fat desktop. And if they can get rid of the desktop, companies like Apple, which again are far from competitive in any realm of anything anymore, they're going to be able to sell you the highest profit margin device and replace the one that costs a lot of money and has a lot of maintenance issues. Because a bigger, badder device is simply going to have more issues because you're pounding the living crap out of the device. For those of you who are parents of kids or you're young enough in this world to know that you're still ebbing your skills forward, the fortunate thing is if you can hear my voice right now and if you're getting this video within 2016, we're not there yet. They haven't really sabotaged out PCs yet. This is a precursor warning to this era ever becoming a reality. It's a precursor warning to Apple getting rid of their desktops, PCs getting rid of their desktops. And what's funny about it, being an Apple guy, I actually fear Apple being the ones to get rid of them first. And then I'll just leave that platform entirely, right? But on the PC side of things, we don't really think about PCs disappearing. Thank God. But the amount of people that have never been on a PC is phenomenal, right? Kids are growing up in mobile devices. And the main PC outlet I think that youthful kids have today, or newcomers to technology, I should say, are laptops. Laptops are sort of the last bastion of kids ever seeing a menu bar across the top, actually using a physical mouse to move things around. But what's funny is these are the units that make all the programs that run on these mobile devices. For those of you who've never written a program in your life, it goes a little something like this. One, you need a hell of a lot of monitor space because you're going to be writing a bunch of text files that actually get what's called compiled to become the application that you run on your mobile device. We have two monitors typically if you're a professional developer. One is the actual simulation of the devices we're putting these programs on. So we run a simulator of a phone, a simulator of a tablet, and we have our development environment in the other monitor, and we're simply writing code, fixing a bug, hitting compile. All of our text gets turned into machine language, which is what the processors on these devices understand, and it runs it over and attaches to the simulators, and we get to see how it runs, and we get to see it fail. Once we got the simulator running really, really well, and doesn't appear to be any crashes, we then get the actual hardware device, and we plug it into our desktop machines, and we run a binary executable, which is what you buy when you buy an application, right? Remember, we used to say .exe on the PC side. It's now a folder called .app on the Mac, but you don't see the suffix, so you think you're double-clicking application. But it starts running that on the actual physical device. And so you make it, you know, you make it run with a bunch of other applications running at the same time, and you see if you have memory problems or memory leaks or any problem you need to resolve. Without a desktop computer, you don't have those basic food groups. So even if your programming environment was pushed on a tablet, which thank God I don't think that exists today, you would have a teeny tiny 10-inch monitor to somehow simulate everything that's going on. The only benefit would be that if you wanted to run it on the actual device, you might be able to compile directly into the device and see how it runs on that one device. But remember the whole memory problem. Memory on these portable devices, it's 4 to 10 times as much as it should be in a cost. So now you're talking about running an environment that costs tremendously more than the desktop. Now, if a memory chip goes bad in a desktop computer, what do? You undo a little door inside your unit, you pull out the old crappy memory chip, you throw it away, and you put another cheapy one in there. Boom, you're set up and you're going. What happens when anything goes wrong with one of these portable devices? And unfortunately, laptops are essentially big glorified mobile devices now. A lot of times, the memory is soldered to the motherboard. And so you have no choice but to replace the entire motherboard of whatever unit you're running. And these computer manufacturers like Apple absolutely love that because they get to charge you an arm and a leg. It's a disposable Razer design. Oh, your computer has a problem. Or your mobile device has a problem. Where we're just going to send it back. You'll get a completely new device, but you're going to essentially pay for the device. A lot of these hardware companies are making repairs cost more than the value of the computers. You know, if you have a 2011 laptop, a Mac Pro, for instance, one of mine's a 2011. I love it. It's a 17-inch computer. It's perfect. It runs beautifully. It records all this audio that you're hearing. Okay? If I have any problem with that thing overheating and I need to replace the motherboard, I'm going to pay $750 just for the board. Just for the board. The computer isn't worth $750. They want me to rationalize, oh, well, you know, replacing the motherboard is going to cost $750. So I might as well just buy a brand new laptop. What's a brand new laptop cost that has the same features of this? Well, it's going to lose 2 inches off the monitor for one thing, so I have this inferior experience afterwards, and I'm going to be playing $14.99, $19.99 for an inferior replacement. Yeah, it might be a lot faster, might have a retinal display, but again, I'm over 40. You know, I have to dial my eyeballs into whatever the hell I'm looking at. So if I'm looking at you guys right now and I'm using my farsightedness, the second I got to read a phone, it takes me damn near 5 minutes to adjust my eyeballs to see stuff super duper close without having to, pull it way away from my face. I know what some of you are thinking. You know, there's the old adage, no country for old men. And that suggests that as people get older, we all get grumpy about the things from our past not existing, which really suggests more of a nostalgic infatuation with the moral fiber of what society used to have, and perhaps an addiction to the devices that we liked. You know, some guys like home stereos with big giant knobs, big tubes, big giant speakers in their house, and that's just the basic food group. Some guys are still infatuated with Beta, VHS, and Laserdiscs because they think it's a better experience. Okay, this isn't that at all. This isn't that at all. You know, how old is the invention of the violin? It's really damn old. I don't even know. It's several hundred years old, I'll tell you that much. But if we were to apply this logic of the post-PC era to actual physical instruments, what Tim Cook is basically saying is none of you should own physical instruments. No brass, no wind, no string. You are supposed to give up all that beautiful tactile emotional input, right? Where your physical, you know, the breath coming out of your chest, the inflection of your mouth on a reed, your method of muting strings and plinking strings and pulling out music, right? For those of you in brass, your mouth on the bit, you know, the way that you push the air through the device. We're supposed to give up all that organic communication through music, which gives it heart, gives it soul, gives it something sentient and an extension of us as human beings. We're supposed to give up all of that so we can use some synthesized piece of crap in a computer. You know, if you pick out, you know, a violin out of a piece of synthesized software out of Native Instruments library, which is a fantastic library, but if you buy their symphony package, you know, and you start using that stuff, then every single time a violin is played, there's very little adjustments you can do with your controller to make it sound different than the next guy over who's using the same exact software with the same exact instrument. You can't stand out as much as you could. You might play totally unique notes and come up with your own score and blah, blah, blah. But let me tell you, there's a reason why orchestras still perform movie scores. You know, Danny Elfman, who's extremely talented at doing movie scores, he plays it at home on synths and a lot of other... He's obviously a massively talented person that could pick up damn near any instrument in planet Earth and play it. But then he takes his score and he blows it out into an orchestrated format, layered beautifully, and he gives it to a team that actually performs it. And that's why when that stuff plays in a movie, we feel its emotion. And if perfectly married with what's going on with the characters inside the film, we shed a tear, we get super excited, we get angry, whatever. We get tense. Stress starts to be involved in the tension and release of a movie. You know, I pick on Apple because I know about them and they're a single target. You know, Microsoft is just a single target of an operating system. You know, but they don't build the hardware half the time, or more than half the time. So you'd have to go after each individual vendor. But I think Windows has managed to, for good or for bad, unify the experience depending on what operating system you're on. If you're one, you know, Windows 7 Professional, everyone wanting Windows 7 Professional is generally having the same experience regardless of what computer they've purchased, minus gaming, right? You know, if you don't have a good video card, you're not going to have a great experience. But Apple's single most talented area of competition is their desktop devices. I should say are their desktop devices, right? Their iMacs are absolutely phenomenal machines. Big, huge 5K monitors for nothing. $19.99, you can get a 5K monitor. It's amazing. I don't know anything about the Mac Pros. I don't know anyone who's willing to buy an inferior machine for $10,000. Yes, it's cheaper than $10,000, but once you build the machine to any professional capacity, it's over $10,000. Unfortunately, Apple made something called Thunderbolt wires, which physically work beautifully, but no one sells them because they didn't take off. So now you have this little 9-inch, this Darth Vader canister, which looks phenomenal, right? It's sort of the cube on crack. And you USB 3 absolutely kills Thunderbolt. But I went to Fry's, and just for kicks, I tried to see if I could buy a Thunderbolt cable, and they looked at me like, we've never sold them, and no one ever asks. You're one of the first people to ever come in here and ask for one. Just made a big stinker, you know? We have to defend not only the sovereignty of our data by having devices that can talk to external hard drives. What are you going to do with your laptop? Your tablet or your iPhone? It doesn't have a mechanism to put an external drive in it. So what are you going to do? By the time you realize that you've lost your sovereignty, it's already gone, right? That's how the world works. And that's why I want to make this video right now, to sort of crush this idea. I don't have anything against mobile devices, and I certainly don't have anything against tablets. I own both, of course. And I do use the living crap out of both units. I mean, I charge them up and I run them down. Every other day, I'm charging them up and running them down, you know? But I also use my desktops, my all-in-ones, and my laptop. I couldn't make this show without a laptop. Again, how would I make this show? How would I take a 58 analog mic, running it into an M-Audio box, and then run it out to a device if I didn't have a laptop? I'd have to put my phone on some goofy tripod holder and then have inferior audio. Like, you know, I've got planes going overhead, helicopters going overhead. I got motorcycles going by because it's Huntington Beach. We wouldn't be able to have this experience because I would never release that low quality experience. But how does the world work in these areas? It works by mass opinion. What I have found in the world is that, you know, once you fear you can't achieve a goal, you have two choices. You are defiant and you say, look, I know I don't know this yet. In fact, I know nothing. But I really know that that's a valuable skill to have, a valuable talent to manifest. And so I'm going to go to school. I'm going to practice until I get that skill. And maybe I changed my mind, which is nothing wrong with that. Some people get all bent out of shape because, you know, they went in to be a particular type of artist and they realize that that's not their bag, but boy, there's something else right next to it. Maybe it's just even related to it, you know? The amount of people I know that went in to be big rock stars and ended up being the greatest sound engineers in the world, I know two or three of them. And now they mix down every album for every major star you know on planet Earth. And I mean the highest name brand names on planet Earth. I know people that wanted to be actors and directors, and they ended up being cinematographers or movie editors. And they became the most talented at that capability. Nothing wrong with that, right? They're happy. They have a talent. But I'm yet to be able to name a single human being on planet Earth that has got a full-fledged talent that's going to last their whole life from a mobile phone or a tablet. Save maybe the conceptual idea, which I don't know any of these people, but we know that there's editors and bloggers out there for whatever period they can write interesting articles to the public. All they need is a little detachable keyboard, and that's fine. They sit in Starbucks and they Imagineer stuff just like me. I'm putting it through video. They just simply do it in word fashion. And actually, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's a small slice of the payable, earnable wages that are out there, right? The kiss of death for America, and I would say even Europe, is allowing yourself and your kids to become 100% consumers. You know, I've told the story many, many times, but when I was a kid, we had, in the 70s, we had these stand-up, what we call coin-op arcade games, right? You put the quarter in, you stand up, and you hold the joystick, and you play a game. Amazing experience. Once that got really popular, the Atari company comes out with their home unit, the 2600. You know, after Pong, right? And all of a sudden, we were at home playing video games through our televisions. It was an amazing experience. By the way, just a little trivia about this. I went to a presentation about those old units once. This is totally off topic, but you'll dig it. Anytime you see an Atari 2600 game, what I never realized was that they had such limited memory in that home unit, right? They were using memory in the cart and they were using memory in the unit at the same time. But every single level in a 2600 game was mirrored left to right. So whatever was on the right side of the screen in terms of the background was actually on the right side of the screen as well. Trippy, right? There's some exceptions where they never did a background, where they actually had, I think, the horrible, weird game. It was brilliantly coded, but the game for, was it Star Command or, no, Star Castle, excuse me. The Star Castle arcade game was a mothership in the middle of this rotating shields in this vectorgraphic engine. And when they created the Atari version, there was no way they could do, you know, rotational mathematics. And so they made a wall of barrier, and the mothership was behind the wall, and you were sitting there hitting it from all different directions. Okay. That simply didn't have a background element, so everything was plotted on the screen. Brilliantly done. I think the guy coded it in a couple weeks. It was unbelievable what they used to do back in those days. But now, back to point. When I got my first computers as a kid, of course I wanted all the video games that were available. You know, I was lucky that my father always got addicted to these units, so I always had the 2600, and then I had the Intellivision, and then I had the ColecoVision. So those three units took care of me all the way through the 80s. But while I had my own home computers, I made games. I made games constantly. And I remember getting on the Epson, my dad's Epson computer, which was really for his accounting, you know, big giant detachable thing, you know, with the CPU, the monitor, and all that stuff. And I played the game Zork. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is fantastic. I walk into a room, it's all text-based, you walk into a room, and you ask it questions, examine this, examine that, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, what did I do as a young teenager? 12, 13, 14 years old, what did I do? Well, I figured out how he did it. I figured out how they made a Zork game. I figured out how they could create rooms in a grid, you know, in a multidimensional array. And then I would put room data in, and I made a haunted house game that was a text-based game. I made a bunch of games, you know. I made funny little things that would paint the screen randomly, so it was like a screensaver almost, except there was no concept of actually saving the screen, but I did a bunch of different stuff. And I became a professional-level programmer by 1987. And when I moved to California, again, this is because I had access to the tool. My whole analogy of you having access to a guitar, you couldn't become a famous guitar player unless you had access to the unit, you know? But when I came here to California in 1987, I worked at Jim Hall Racing for a few months, and then I got a job at the founders of what's now known as TurboTax. It was called Macintax back in the day. Yeah, I knew computers so well that when I moved out here, I had my class ring on my finger from high school. And I remember more than once sitting, eating dinner or lunch or whatever with my coworkers who all had their degrees. They'd done 10 years working for the military. And they'd ask me all the time, well, what college is that ring from? And I'm looking at them really funny because my face is covered with pimples. I look thin and young. And I'm like, well, I never went to college. I'm coming here straight from high school. And it was a mind blower for them. And the only reason why that was capable of happening was I had access to full desktop computers to learn these languages. And again, I'm going to tell you that there's a imperative physical difference between using these little tiny injection molded units and being a professional. We know right now in America that kids are getting degrees and getting $100,000+ in debt with degrees that have no capability of getting them a job. And for those of you who are parents, you have to support your kid for the rest of their lives. And you have to toil to keep them from getting so depressed they get on psychotropic drugs in order to control their brains, to keep them from being depressed. My kid's going through college right now, right? And she told me that the amount of antidepressants going around is crazy. It's just these kids talk to each other and they say, oh, you're having problems with your tests? Well, go get Ritalin. That's one of the big things that the kids talk to each other because they're all doctors, right? They all know how to prescribe these medicines. They get a bunch of ADHD, ADD drugs and they take them. Meanwhile, they're also pounding plenty of booze, plenty of weed, plenty of other drugs, and they're mixing them all together in their brain. And those are highly educated kids doing this. This isn't your bottom of the barrel kids. I have to assume that this regiment, this sentiment is going across all ages. But that's what these kids have to do nowadays. And there's no guarantee at the end of the game that they're going to be able to deal with life. Because if you have to use a chemical to get through college, and you know, college can be more difficult than regular life, of course. But what if life is hard? What if all of this get rich and be famous for doing nothing mentality of the 21st century doesn't pan out for these kids? Then what happens? You know, what if a kid has a 4-year degree and the only job he can get is stuffing groceries into a grocery bag? Where would the kid ever get additional skills? Let's say they're a completely motivated human being. We're in this Tim Cook post-PC era. Now, the only thing the child has access to is a tablet and a telephone. How does the kid ever become a true musician? Now, you could say, well, go buy the instruments and do it. But how do they become a professional Photoshop person, professional video editor, professional music editor? In fact, they got the guitar, they know how to play it, but they can't seem to bring together a song because these little make-believe music studios that are on the tablets, and they do have these remote devices that let you put in analog units. But they have this teeny tiny screen to put it all together. And it just becomes an absolutely cumbersome methodology to live. And you might say, oh, well, these kids are going to get used to these. They're already used to these really small interfaces. So to them, it's not a big deal. You're the old man that needs a 24 or 27-inch monitor or whatever. You know, count your blessings is all I got to say. Because eventually that ain't going to work out. You know? Eventually, you're going to want to create bigger art. It's almost like taking Michelangelo, right? And saying, don't do David for 3 years. Don't carve David out of a piece of marble for 3 years. Here's your tiny piece of marble that's the size of a shoebox. Knock yourself out, guy. Would you put that in a museum? No. It's not amazing. It was a limited medium to begin with. So what do we do? What do we do about the post-PC era? Because we're just people talking to each other or listening to each other online. It's tough. I think the number one thing we can do is heighten the awareness amongst us. If you're among us, I keep putting the ST on there. If you're a blogger about this subject matter, maybe you write an interesting article that is telling everyone how much bullshit the post-PC era really is. Take everything I've just said in this video presentation or audio presentation, depending on how you're getting it, and itemize it in your article, saying this is what disappears if we get rid of a desktop computer. A personal computer is being demonized. You know, I think someone will probably continually make a desktop. I think Windows is going to essentially win if Apple gets rid of their desktops. Now, Tim Cook's not announced anything about the day he's going to sunset these devices, but they've already gotten rid of a 17-inch laptop. I haven't talked to a human on earth that thinks that's a good idea. Everyone's hanging on to their 17-inch laptops, but we know that if we upgrade the operating system, they'll simply run subroutines that make the computer really slow, or they'll run very inefficient subroutines that burns out our video cards. But you know what? The hardware is not going to last forever, no matter how beautifully made it is. No matter if we never upgrade, it's going to eventually expire just because things do expire. Silicon loses its emulsion, loses its atomic collection. It's going to eventually fry out. Then what? We go from living in a sovereign plot of land to living inside of a jail cell. You know, and a jail cell is not freedom, which means what you're capable of doing with your life, both from traveling and dreaming up new ideas. You can't play a baseball game inside of a jail cell, but you could play a really crappy baseball game in my yard. At least you could play it. You could play catch, at least. So the destiny of man relies on continuing to be innovators and creators and not just consumers. Like I've said it several times, I write. Okay. I've been to lots of seminars / workshops with my teacher, Robert McKee. I've read dozens and dozens of books on it. I have a writing mentor who's sold 20 scripts and made one of the most cult movies of the 80s ever. And so I have a really intense grasp on storytelling. It doesn't mean everything I crank out's, you know, as good as these guys, but I understand what is good and what isn't good in terms of originality, turns, emotional investment, that kind of stuff. All right. When I sit down and watch shows with people, it's usually 2/3 of the time extremely painful because the dialogue is trite. It's slow. It's so predictable that, you know, you're essentially, you could write the rest of whatever you're watching, a television show or a movie, after 5 or 10 minutes, because it's just all a foregone conclusion. There's no mystery. And the reason why that is, and the reason why the stuff, maybe in the past certain shows are made and they were innovative back in the time and you watch them 20 years later and you're like, oh my God, that's horrible. Hey, that happens, right? It's because, you know, society evolved past that mindset. All right. You'll find that the further back you go, the more intelligent things are, honestly. If you go back to watch Casablanca, you'll realize that we're idiots today, you know? But eventually, this consumerism is going to infect everything that we do. And the reason why that stuff can be created today, the reason why these kids can listen to music that's auto-tuned, You know, music has barely changed in 10 years. And I'm going to tell you right now, you know, in the 80s, we have music that actually invented the 80s. You know, like I did an episode on, I forgot exactly which one. It's one of my creative episodes. I talk about Gary Numan, the guy who wrote the song Cars. You can play Cars today to a kid who's 14 years old and they're panting. They're like, damn, that sounds really cool, really new, and really innovative. And what I always tell them is, yeah, and it felt that way in 1980 when that song hit the deck. But, you know, 20 years now, 30 years in the future, if we play any of the songs made in the last 10 years, not so much, right? Because you play the next tune, the next tune, the next tune, they're going to sound exactly the same. And that's because our kids are being turned into consumers. Consumers are what fuel socialism. Consumers is what fuels fascism, despotism, serfdom, glorified versions of slavery. We need to set a standard and enable that standard with devices sometimes. I mean, yes, we could all sit around and be philosophers and, you know, be big thinkers and stuff, but it's, at some point you got to write down what you've thought, even if you're this crazy physicist or electrical engineer. You're still going to need to write stuff down, because we keep trying to push the envelope of all thought. We're using software now, like Mathematica, to see if what we thought will actually work. How many movies do you watch where there's a computer-generated character or computer-generated landscape or set piece or special effect in the scene? That's never going to happen on a phone, and it's never going to happen inside of a tablet and be worth anything. How is someone going to create a 5K movie that's going to be broadcast in a movie theater on these tiny little crappy devices? And what's interesting about it is, let's say that you like Apple computers. You love them. All right. Well, they're going to go away if the leader of that company right now gets his way. And I don't think it's Tim Cook's idea. I think he's pushing it. You know, there's all kinds of weird agendas going on in America right now. And one of them is that all of our ATM cards are being replaced. Our debit cards, right? They're being replaced with these chip cards. And it went from, take your card and swipe it on a unit, and you get instantaneous read of the magnetic strip on the back of the card. They're going to these units where you got to put the card inside and read the chip. Something that is the speed of light. But how's the experience really work nowadays? This is in the last 6 months of America. You put the card in and you have to let it sit there. You have to let it sit there for damn near 10 seconds at some convenience stores. They're forcing all the convenience stores to replace all their ATM units because they say, well, we don't want to do swiping anymore. It's for security, which is a joke if there ever was one. As long as the number is printed on the outside of the card with the expiration date and the little CVS number on the back, someone just needs to look at your card and they got you. You know, sometimes they require zip codes to help you out, but why is that occurring? Why do they put chips in our cards and take an instantaneous swipe mechanism at McDonald's or wherever the hell you're using your card, and they've turned it into a 10 to 15 second push thing? You know, I go to the ATM at Chase Manhattan Bank and I put my card in. It used to be you put your card in, you pulled it out, and then you would have your whole transaction and then you'd stop. Well, now it takes your card and locks it into the unit. It actually goes, green light goes to a yellow light saying, and you try to pull your card out, it's locked in there. It's physically locked in the unit. You do your whole transaction, then it unlocks your card and you take your money. Now, maybe that's good because someone can't go in after you if you forget to kind of hang up the phone on your ATM. Someone could go after you and do another withdrawal. But it hasn't been a problem up to this point. I don't have any friends that have had that problem. The reason why that's happening is because they want everyone to buy everything through a telephone. They're trying to make the telephone the only instantaneous purchase mechanism. So they're creating a path of most resistance with the path that used to be the least resistance unit. And they're taking this inferior experience, which is using your telephone. Go to a Starbucks, go to any place where people can buy stuff with the telephone, and just watch how slow that is. It's no faster than an ATM card was. And half the time, these kids have to dial up the app to get to their pay mechanism. There's so many barcode apps now at Starbucks. You know, you have to get the kid. You're waiting in line for the person to do the pay thing. But they have to run the app. They have the little bar that says, this is me. And so they've been texting the whole time, chatting, screwing around line. And then when it comes time to pay, oh, wait, let me get out of this. Oh, let me launch. Oh, gosh, it's stuck on the fourth screen. Let me hang. And you're waiting for some kid to launch the barcode app. I'm sure they're going to improve that a little bit. But they're trying to get us to a cashless society right now. And what is cash? Cash is exactly like your hard drive. It's a sovereign unit of payment, right? You know, my co-host Kyle, he worked at Apple for a little while and tried to go in the cafeteria and give him $20 for lunch. He's going to pay for everyone behind him too as part of his group. They wouldn't take it. They wouldn't take cash. You know, you might just write that off and say, well, they don't want cash on the premises. They don't want to have a Brinks truck have to come pick up the deposits and that kind of stuff. All right, I might write you a blank check there. It is a private, you know, for-profit piece of land. They don't have to actually honor things like legal tender. But now we've seen that echoed in reality. That's where they're going. So in the meantime, until this lunacy of post-PC era either eclipses all sanity and we lose desktop computers forever, buy hard drives. Okay? Buy hard drives. And I'm going to tell you right now, your safest methodology of doing this, just from a data recovery standpoint, is the following. Buy separate hard drives and either buy them inside the enclosure that can be attached to your computer. If you need a little USB hub, do that. But buy them separately. And the reason is, because the other option is what's called a RAID. And a RAID is when you put four or five drives inside of this RAID encasement, and it actually treats them all as one big giant drive. The problem with that, and you can run your risk if you want to, and a lot of my guys in special effects, they have to run RAIDs in their mind, because it does. You need a little bit of software if you're going to run them separately, but the idea is when the RAID goes dead, your data recovery costs are exponentially higher for every drive you put in the RAID. What's that mean? Well, let's say you have one drive, and let's say you have four external drives that are run separately. And you simply organize your business to run on the four different drives. And every piece of software that I know of facilitates that beautifully. Final Cut facilitates that beautifully. One goes dead. You take that one drive to your data recovery place, and you're going to pay out the ass for it. But it's still going to most likely have the data. Okay. When you bring in a group of RAID disks, let's say you had four disks in a RAID system, you're going to take the price you would have paid for the one drive to do data recovery, and you're going to pay 2, 3, 4x times the cost, because they're all unified into one gigantic drive. And the data recovery places have to take your drives, put them in these bays, do a big giant bit copy of the drive onto a healthy drive, and do that for every single RAID that you have, okay? And then they run this incredibly intense software that reconstructs the data. And it is truly a pain in the ass for the people that do the RAID or disk recovery. I've got a friend of mine that does disk recovery for a living. He does everything, right? He actually recovers stuff from Sandy Hook, okay? It's more expensive, and it's dangerous, so just know that. A couple other things you need to know if you want to keep your data safe and if you don't want to lose your data, all right? There's this new thing called a solid-state drive. Most of you have heard of it. A lot of you own them. It's a drive made out of memory. Same exact stuff. Flash memory. It's extremely fast, very efficient, and it is a superior experience, especially if you put your operating system on an SSD drive. Your computer boots up in 2 seconds. Now, the truth of the matter is that, again, back in the early 90s, Apple actually had a feature inside their operating system 7, where you could take any of the memory on your computer, partition out a little piece of it, and put your operating system on it, and you could reboot your computer off your memory. You know, as long as your computer didn't lose 100% power, it always worked. And I used to use it all the time. It was amazing. My computer never made a sound. It just booted really, really fast. Okay. So I'm going to give you a tip, and I'm going to give you a caution all at the same time. If you have an SDD drive and you erase something off that drive, it is gone forever. So if you have data that needs to be protected and you don't want anyone else to have it, get an SDD drive, because as soon as you erase it, it's gone. If you have data that you can't lose, then if you have an SDD drive inside your computer, you need an external hard disk to save your data on, such that it could be recovered if it ever has a problem. Now, my experience, just a little tip from me too, is that Western Digital, often called WD, has the best external drives on planet Earth. So if you want to get an external drive brand that's going to be really well supported by the company, and their support is way better than they tell the world. And that's all I'm going to tell you. If you have problems with their drives, they actually work with you more than any company I know, because they have pride still, I guess. Yeah, you will also hear journalists. I believe I heard this on the Max Kaiser show. He had a journalist on there that said that, you know, as they write articles, if they don't put it in the cloud, you know, a lot of them will crack stories, right? So they're cracking a conspiracy somewhere in the world. And if their data is on a cloud, there are government people in various regions of the world. You can think of every first world country on planet Earth. They read what's in the cloud illegally, and they will come to that person and threaten them to not write the article or not to publish the article. Or they'll work through other means to get them fired or whatever. This is according to the journalists that do this. Okay, I haven't personally experienced this. But what they said in Max Kaiser, and what I confirmed with my data recovery buddy, is that he said, on Max Kaiser's show, we use removable memory sticks. And we put all the files on the removable memory stick, which is essentially a slower version of an SDD drive. Now, the difference between the two is that in an SDD drive, you have what's called flash memory, which is super duper fast. And most of the memory sticks are made out of just regular old memory. It takes a long time to copy something to it and copy something off of it. But when you're writing a little tiny Word document that's your coveted piece of information, the nice thing is that once it's erased, just like an SDD drive. Now, that doesn't, like I said in my How They're Spying on You episode, for those of you who haven't seen that, you want to go see it if you want to know how real internet spying happens, right? Because no one's revealed it. Snowden, who everybody thinks is real, has never exposed exactly how they do it. And they basically, you know, once you transmit your data over the internet, all right, it bounces off all these routers, thousands and thousands of routers to get the data to the cloud. Now, once it's in a cloud, depending on the company you're getting your cloud service from, and I would say damn near 99% of them are co-opted by intelligence, because it's law now in America, even though it violates the Fourth Amendment. Military Commissions Act, if you need to see the details, right? They enforced the violation of the Constitution of the United States on corporations through the Military Commissions Act in the name of 9/11, of course, right? Because we need to get rid of freedom in America because we were attacked supposedly by some Arabs that have all paid their dues, right? But once it's transmitted, it's theirs forever. They can crack it immediately. And again, most of us don't have anything to worry about in these scenarios. And again, you watch that episode, I'll tell you how they make patsies and how, even though you're an innocent citizen, if they need a patsy that matches your profile, they can make you that guy or that girl. They can throw you under the bus, right? So if you like Apple, for instance, let's just use them as an example, because they have the most unified power to dismiss their PC brand products, their iMacs and their Mac Pros and their MacBooks, right? Those are the PCs that they say are obsolete now, right? And supposedly if you buy those units, you're just an old fart. They'll be the first company, I predict, to truly get rid of the desktop platform if this lunacy continues. But if you like Apple and you want Apple to exist in the future, you need to recognize the fact that, again, they're not competitive in any of the other platforms that they suggest. They've been living off so much fanboy energy, which is the denial that they are actually competitive, that they believe their own hype. But if you have an investment portfolio in Apple stock, for instance, then you can't afford to have them get rid of the PC era, which is their only competitive region in what they do. They're living off of expanding into markets that don't have the iPhone, like China and India. It's a game. That's a game they're playing. You know, they bring the unit prices down so those people in those regions can afford them. But they're going to lose to Android. They absolutely, bona fide, will lose to Android. And it won't matter if you can charge your phone across the room without a charge pad. You know, if they bring back Tesla's patents and make it happen, it won't matter if you make a an Apple car. They're constantly moving into these markets that they don't have Steve Jobs to help them get over the hump. Steve Jobs might have been able to make some of these new regions competitive, but we know that the crew at Apple no longer has has the knowledge of how to make something competitive. They reach out to their fanboy base, which is a lot of their employees, either within the Infinite Loop group of people that work for them, or they reach out to their fan base at their Apple stores, their employees, or they reach into the forums and they believe their own hype. Well, it seems like everybody likes it. Okay, you're reading your own PR feedback loops. If you don't want to lose that particular platform, then you got to demonize this whole post-PC era thing. And that's just a financial thing. That's just a preferential platform thing. That's not talking about making all of the world a consumer and not a creator. I think Windows, you know, whenever Apple closes it off, it'll be amazing to me to have all of these PC, tower manufacturers simply follow suit. Because what else do they make? Nothing, right? Some of these great PC manufacturers don't make telephones. Were they going to give up billions of dollars of revenue simply because Apple wants to commit Harry Carey? I don't think so. But if you're a Mac guy and you totally love it and you don't want to use Windows 10, well, isn't that a beautiful masterpiece? You're going to need to get on the horn. Get inside forums. Let them know that this is crazy. It's for the betterment of society that we have the tools to become talented. Getting rid of a personal computer is going to stunt the growth of humanity because it's going to make us all consumers. You know, I have plenty of friends of mine of all ages that have tablets, iPads or tablets, right? And I ask them, I say, well, what do you use it for? That's a great tablet, man. That's an amazing tablet. They say, well, you know, I try to use it for business, but the software is usually inferior, missing a bunch of features. I hate soft keyboards. I don't want to pay $120 for a detachable keyboard. What the hell's the point of that? It's just building a PC slowly, a slower, smaller PC for more money or equal amount of money. So no one ever uses them for anything serious. You're going to have that one friend that does. But what, you want to have one friend that owns the whole universe? You don't want your own ability to get into this stuff? We have viewers that are studying all kinds of stuff in school. You know, they're learning art of all different kinds. They're also learning physical art on the outside, but they're also using software on the inside of their computers. I can tell you right now, you'll never become a Pixar animator, a digital domain animator, a Weta animator running on a freaking tablet. I think you feel me. This is something that's, I think, incredibly important. But it just goes one ear in one ear and out the other for society. You know, we're so into this archetype of existence, which is we must demonize something 24/7. Something has to be the enemy. And I think that that comes from the fact that we are told that there's enemies that we can't do anything about. Right? These intelligence-funded terrorist organizations that walk into concerts in Paris and blow everybody away. Never get caught. Right? And as long as they have dark hair and olive skin, all the white people are more than willing to believe the stories about where these people came from. And now the one enemy that we think we can fight and win is sovereign cash, PCs, debit cards being extremely fast, easy to use, right? Hard drives that we can put our stuff on inside of our house. If you build your house properly, by the way, and you have all these external drives and you keep your most important stuff on the external drive, and your house catches on fire. You know, it depends on when you find that process, in that process. But let's say you had the ability to run down your hallway to your office or wherever the hell you keep this stuff. And for those of you who know what network drives are, you can put them on your network as well, but they're a little bit slow because it's Ethernet transmission and not, bus-to-bus transmission. But you could keep a little duffel bag that's big enough to hold your drives. And you merely put your hand on your drives, yank the cables out, the power and the data, pick them up, and stick them inside their bag and haul ass. And you could save your data. If nothing else, you could toss them out the window. At least the data is recoverable, even if they suffer a concussion from being dropped. But if your bag's got a little bit of puff in it, you're going to be fine. Sling it around your shoulder. If it matters to you, right? Just some food for thought. So this is your episode about the post-PC era. Now, just a little bit more about the show here. I thought I had published most of my episodes that I had in the queue. And so I was going through the master footage and I was realizing, oh my God, I got half a dozen shows I haven't released yet. So you're going to get, I'm going to try to put this in, you know, the more recent publications here so you can kind of get some information about the episodes that are coming. But you're going to see some episodes are all bundled up in my my jackets and stuff because it's really, really cold. And I'm doing it in the more of the Arctic temperatures of December and January. So you're going to see these come in the mix. So there's probably at least half a dozen out there that I think are going to be really cool for you guys. So I'm editing a couple of them together right now. But yeah, we have created again the Deep Thoughts Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/deepthoughtsradio. It's, you know, it's slowly moving up here. But what we want to do is really get people to participate, posting the videos that are sort of about, you know, all these subjects of ancient history and that sort of thing. We're keeping the darker content over at our facebook.com/MKUltraRadio. So if you want to get the more political stuff, the more acidic stuff that's going on in the universe, that's where that stuff is, just in case this is your first episode. But anyway, if you have any questions, or you forget those URLs later on in life, just remember you're watching MK Ultra Radio. So if you go to mkultraradio.com, all the feeds are up there. It's all separated. We've redone our Facebook, we've redone the WordPress page such that you can get the episodes right on the front. So the most recent ones are right there on the front. The video, the link to the videos, or whatever you need. Again, if you dig this kind of content, obviously subscribe. If you like this particular episode, a thumbs up is awesome. It does help help our stuff get watched by other people. So, again, this is all about kind of insulating the past from being erased and to prepare ourselves for the future, to heighten the level of conversation about things that matter. So hopefully you feel me on this. But as I always say, take care of yourself and somebody else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts episode. Over now. Only.